Good afternoon. So last time we talked about how when we have a system that supports multiple users, how we can decide, and part of how we can implement restrictions on what programs on that system can do. And one problem we had is that typically we want to say what a program can do is based on who's running it. That if I log into Portal and run LS, the things I can list should be different than the things you can list logging into Portal and running LS. So we need some way of identifying who's running the program. And we talked specifically about the mechanisms for doing this and implementing the checks for who can do what on kind of classic Unix-like systems. And what those Unix-like systems have decided to do is track a user ID and a group ID with each process, each running program. And normally the way things work is, you know, we log into the system, the program we log in with, the shell that's going to run other programs, runs with our user ID and group IDs, and programs that it creates by default have the same user ID and group IDs. And at some point when that program tries to do something, the operating system is going to compare that user and group ID stored with the program with some list associated with whatever resource we're trying to access. And we talked about a specific format that list would have for files, because files are typically where we're implementing the most interesting policies as far as about what programs can access them. And we mentioned the kind of classic from the probably 70s Unix file permissions that, you know, still kind of the most ubiquitous thing supported today on kind of server-like systems, where we have read, write, and execute bits, and a separate set of those bits for one user, who we call the owner of the file, one group, and a set for any processes which don't match that user ID or that group ID. And to make this work, we also have a user ID and group ID associated with each file. And when I say file here, I mean directories included as well as regular files. And we mentioned, well, maybe that's not flexible enough. So we can imagine a scheme that's a bit more complicated to implement, but lets us do policies that are not possible in that sort of classic Unix scheme of these general access control lists, where rather than having one user ID, one group ID, we have arbitrarily many and corresponding can they read, write, execute, etc. this file. So that was kind of our normal permission checking talked about last time. Now, there was something we realized was kind of missing here, and we needed kind of a story for one thing is like, how does the right user ID get associated with each process to begin with? And also, there were cases that we couldn't really elegantly handle in this system. And we talked about the mechanism that Unix uses to deal with these two problems. And one key tool is that we reserve one user ID to be very special, user ID number 0, which is typically called root or super user, where we just have a policy that rather than checking that list associated with each file, we're just going to say yes if it's user ID 0. Just passes all the checks. And this enables us to have some programs run where they mostly don't care about permission checks, and we can allow operations that we normally wouldn't allow programs to do. And this gives us the tools we need to implement a program like login or an SSH server, where you can access this program, perhaps because it runs right after boot, and you can type a password in, and the program can decide if you're allowed to be a particular user. And we give programs running as root the permission to do this operation we wouldn't normally give programs of changing their user ID. And the system administrator can install programs that, for example, check for passwords in the correct way, and thereby implement login. And an elegant part of this scheme is that we implemented password checking in a way where the kind of core part of the OS knows nothing about passwords. There's no code in that core part of the OS that's always running, that tracks all these user IDs, that understands how passwords work. They don't even understand what usernames are. Doesn't need to know that, keeps that code simpler, and also means that if the system administrator wants to change how passwords work, like if they want to replace passwords with fingerprint checks, well, it's just replacing that login program. They don't have to change most of the OS. And another issue we talked about is, well, after we're logged in, sometimes we want to let users do things that normally the permission checks wouldn't allow. And like one thing we could imagine doing is we could imagine modifying that kernel part of the OS to have all these sort of extra special cases to allow sort of individual extra access. But that's really hard, really inflexible, and we want some more flexible scheme. And Unix has this kind of escape hatch of a set user ID bit, where the system administrator can configure a program to run as the program's owner, typically as root. And by choosing what that program does, it can selectively give users access to extra functionality. So we saw the example of this sudo program that's pretty common on Linux systems, where the system administrator installs the sudo program, and the sudo program gives users access to things that they normally couldn't do, and it's able to do that because it runs as root. But it doesn't give users indiscriminate access. The access is limited to what the program will do, and that program has checks. It says, if you're in a configuration file, if you type a password, then I'll do these things, otherwise I'll just print a message and exit. And this lets the system administrator easily sort of add selective ability for users to do things without needing to modify that core part of the OS to add all these special cases for the weird things they want users to be able to do that normally wouldn't be allowed. And another example that might be maybe a better motivation is like if I have a USB drive mounted, plugged in, and visible in my system, and I want normal users to be able to detach it safely, well, that's probably something I would like to have be possible without root. But it's going to be hard for me to tell the core part of the OS, please let people catch USB devices, but not the internal hard drive, which would break the whole system. But I can relatively easily write a program which implements whatever checks I want to make to say, you know, is this safe for a normal user to attach or not, without needing to have the core part of the OS understand sort of what I think is a safe device to attach versus not. Some questions about these things we covered last time. So about sort of this escape hatch and this tracking of user IDs, comparing it to these access control lists. Not seeing any at the moment. Okay, so today our main topic is going to be kind of more about how this kind of authorization check, you know, is enforced, like why programs can't get around it, what support we have from the hardware to make that possible. Before I move on to that, I'm going to do a little bit of logistics on this monitor. And we're going to talk about quizzes, so how the quiz works. So we're going to have a quiz site that looks something like this. It won't look exactly like this because the quizzes won't be called example quiz. And if you looked on the schedule, there's a quiz released tonight due before the first lecture on next Tuesday. That's 9:15, not 12:15. And the quiz site, when you go to it, you can open up a quiz. You'll have something like this, and you can enter your answers. And when you do so, the box around the question will turn green. If it does so, your answer has been recorded. And you can, for example, you know, go back away from the quiz, open it back up later, and your answers will still be there, and you can still edit up until the deadline. Whatever answers are recorded last will be what we take, what we use. You can write some comments or work on a question. So yeah, with whatever you want us to look at to try to give you partial credit or, you know, reflect on something that's wrong with the question. You notice that the box around the question is yellow. My comment isn't recorded yet. If I click outside of the box, now it's green, my comment's recorded. If it doesn't go green, then you might have some network problem and it's not there. You can always check by, you know, reopening the page entirely. And generally your answers will be recorded immediately. You can go back as many times as you want up till the deadline. You know, it's not required to be done in one sitting. After the quiz is due, you will see that it will be automatically graded. This is marked as correct. We'll have it probably a little more clearly marked as correct. We have these percentages indicating what students actually answered, so you can tell if questions are something people commonly got wrong or not for multiple choice. And also, if after the quiz is due, we'll have probably in about a week, some TAs look over comments and things like that. Also check for cases where maybe we missed something in the automatic key. Like if we have a written answer, we might not get all the correct forms of the answer. So we'll have TAs try to take care of that in about a week. And you may sometimes have feedback, you know, about comments there, indicating if any adjustment was made, so on. And there's also a place here if you want to submit a regrade request, have us look at it for that question. So about comments, if you don't write a comment, we can't give you partial credit for the most part. So please do that in relevant cases. Usually I can't give clarifications on the quiz questions just as a practical matter. So if you come to me on Sunday and say, I think this quiz question's unclear, probably realistically, I have to kind of say, I can't help you, or, you know, I have to drop the question because a bunch of people probably did the quiz on Friday and I don't want to tell them, sorry for doing the quiz early, too bad. You have to go back and see if this clarification changes your answer. I'm not going to do that. I will deal with sort of doing the best we can with the question as written, or if it's too bad, dropping it just from the quiz rather than making clarifications. Also, like, some percentage of things people think are unclear are just like, this is something we expect you to know, that sort of thing. So in general, if you think something in the quiz is unclear, please describe in the comment like how that affected your answer. For example, if you think information was missing or you needed to make an assumption to answer the question, describe that in the comment and we can take that into account when grading. If it turns out the question is bad, we can, you know, maybe adjust it, drop it, or adjust it in some way like that. Obviously, I hope to have our question screened well enough, but, you know, inevitably, with hundreds of students, some of you will find different ways to read questions that we won't anticipate and our TAs won't anticipate. So, questions, yes? So the question is, how do points for a question like this work?
Yeah, let's say there's two.
It is as if each, in general, each option is worth the same number of points, meaning that you get points for each option that matches the key.
And if you get one that's, like, if you get an X, like, let's say there's two that are true, just like both of those and an extra one, or do you get all points off or part
of it? It's as if each option is an individual question with its own score. That answer your question? Yeah, so that's how select multiple work, yeah. As if each option is kind of individual question worth a fraction of the points of the overall question. Yes?
Sorry, this is probably dumb, but what stops you from selecting every single option on the point?
You can select every single option and each option is worth a certain number of points. So here, I have lost points, because I selected it and it's not correct. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, and so as I mentioned, the first quiz is released tonight and due before lecture on Tuesday. And it's before the first lecture, it's 9:15. I'm mentioning this again because I've had problems with people not noticing that in the past. So, any other quiz logistics questions? Okay. So, as I said, we're going to talk about how we enforce that programs can't access files they're not supposed to. There's actually a bunch of things we want programs to not be able to do, and we're going to talk a bit about how that's enforced and what happens when programs try to get around that, why they functionally can't get around that. And we're going to start with what we just talked about, kind of the policy side of reading others' files. What is the actual implementation that prevents programs from reading each other's files, reading other users' files, I should say. And the tricky part here is if we think of what's going on here, we need some combination of the hardware and operating system to allow you to read your own files and disallow you to read others' files. And Brad Campbell mentioned last time that we have this way called a system call where you request to read files that is the solution we ended up at. And to think about that, I'll talk about what are the solutions we could have and look at the system call solution, which we'll go into a little more detail about why that's kind of what we ended up at. So one way we could imagine implementing this restriction is that we could have the OS tell the hardware before it runs your program that, hey, this program can access this part of the disk, give it a list, for example. This is not what we do, and if you think of the logistics, this involves some pretty complicated communication between the hardware and the OS, and it's communication with this what's supposed to be a relatively simple storage device that now has to understand some complex set of rules. We learned we can have these access control lists with group IDs, really complex set of rules for what can be accessed. So for this reason, we don't implement this because this would just be a lot of work, even though it's a valid idea. Another thing we could imagine doing is we want to say, that required too much parts of the hardware. The hardware needs to have a really complicated interface to do that. Let's try a solution where we don't ask anything of the hardware, where the hardware, just doesn't know anything about what's going on whatsoever. And what we can do that is we can just make sure whatever programs we load never try to access the disk in the wrong way, and just check that before we load it. This is a thing you can do, but this is pretty complex for the OS, and probably most importantly, to make this practical, we need to compile our programs in a very different way to make it possible for the OS to look at them and figure out, this will never do a bad disk access. So instead, we're going to want some help from the hardware. We're not going to be able to have the hardware implement our whole policy, just a part of it. And what we're going to have help from the hardware with is that the OS is going to tell the hardware, basically, that only the OS code is allowed to access the hard drive. And we're going to pay a cost here that this means that when a program wants to access the hard drive, the OS is going to have its code do it on the program's behalf. And this is the cost we're paying for being able to enforce these kind of access control lists and things like that, which are not something we can have the hardware do itself. And we still are relying on some help from the hardware, in that the hardware does need to enforce some properties of how programs run for us, and it is to prevent the program from directly accessing a hard drive, and also needs to provide a mechanism we've learned is going to be called system calls for the program to ask the OS to do it on its behalf. So our mechanism to prevent the program from directly accessing the hard drive and other I/O devices is going to be in our processor. We're going to add an extra register, which is going to indicate if we're in kernel mode or not. You may also see this referred to as privilege mode or supervisor mode or a whole bunch of different names. And if that register is set, we're in kernel mode. If it's clear, we're going to be in what's called user mode. And the hardware is going to implement our restriction by saying that certain operations, like talking to the hard drive, or actually probably any input or output device, is only allowed if we're in kernel mode, only if that register is set to 1. And the OS can use this to enforce its restriction by making sure whenever it runs your code only runs in user mode. So there's nothing you can do to talk to the hard drive except ask the OS to do it for you. So questions about this kernel mode idea? So then we need to talk about how does this register get set to the right value? And startup is easy. So our system's going to boot in kernel mode. It's going to run the OS. The OS is going to start whatever program starts in our system. And whenever the OS runs program code, it's going to switch to user mode. Now we need to talk about, well, if we switch to user mode, how do we switch back to kernel mode? And we can't just let your program set the register back to 1 directly, because that would defeat the whole point that you can't, you know, access this privileged functionality except through the OS. There needs to be some restriction on that. So we'll have a special mechanism to get back to the OS code in kernel mode. So what's this is going to give us is that we'll have our programs are going to run with the kind of limited hardware interface. So this is going to have like a lot of useful functionality, like say, you know, push, pop, call, add, multiply, lots of things that are pretty useful. Move. But there's going to be some instructions that are restricted to this kernel mode. So there's a more complete hardware interface available to the kernel. And when we want to get to that functionality, we're going to do it by making a request to the OS through this system call interface. And we'll talk exactly about, you know, how that interface works with a specific example, like what calling it on Linux looks like. Questions? Yes, back there.
So does x86 have its own set of elevated privilege instructions?
Question, does x86 have its own set of elevated privilege instructions? So there is a set of instructions in x86 that only work in privilege mode, if that's what you mean, or I guess only do something useful in privilege mode. As we'll learn, you know, when you run an instruction that doesn't do something useful in privilege mode, it's still an instruction. It just is going to tell the OS, hey, this program did something bad. It's not going to not exist. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So the system call interface, how is that going to work? And we could imagine, you know, saying, well, this should be like function calls. Like I have a library call interface. So what we would want if we were imitating how libraries work is that I just call a function and we just have a special case that it runs stuff in kernel mode. That idea doesn't quite work. So let's say I wanted to implement the interface where I can run OS code by just calling a function there. Well, it'd be nice for me to call this function here. So here's a function intended to read files. Right, I pass a file name, I pass where to put the data from the file, and this function checks if I can access it, and if so, it gives me that data. So we'd like to give programs access to that function, but we don't want to give programs access to run this function in a way that will work, because this function doesn't have the can program access file check. And it's going to be in the OS's code, because of course we have a utility function that actually does the work. So when we give the program the ability to make calls to the OS, we're not going to give the program the ability to make kind of any function call in the OS. We're going to give a very carefully restricted set, and therefore we're not going to have something that looks exactly like a call instruction. Like with a call instruction, you say call and choose an address to go to. We can't give that because that's too dangerous. We want to make sure programs only call the safe functions and don't call the unsafe functions. So questions? So the solution that we've kind of arrived at on most systems is that we'll have a special instruction to make a system call, a call to the operating system. And this is a similar idea to a call instruction in that we're going to jump to some code in the OS, and eventually it's going to return back to us if things work, quote unquote, normally. But rather than us specifying where in the OS to go, it's going to run at a location specified earlier at boot. That when the OS boots, it's going to tell the processor, here's where system calls go. And they're always going to go exactly there. Normal programs can't change that. And you need to be in kernel mode to change that, so that's why they're not going to change it. So we're going to have this one instruction that jumps to this handler routine. So that code in the handler routine at that location the OS configures at boot needs to first figure out what does the program actually want to do. And also it needs to do this in a way where we know we aren't going to get fooled by the program. So for figuring out what the program wants, this should remind you of calling conventions. That, you know, when we do a function call, we have arguments we look for, and it's not because the function call instruction does anything with the arguments typically, it's just because we know I expect to look for a particular value in this register, and I know if that's 7, I'm doing this, that sort of thing. Well, we have some convention about what the routine is going to look for to decide what the program is requesting to do. And this is going to look very much like how in a function call we have a convention on where arguments are and what they mean that makes the function call actually useful. But it's not something the hardware does, it's something the assembly in that function we call does. And here, this is not something the hardware is doing, it's something the OS is doing, and implementing that is figuring out what the program wants based on some convention where we've agreed that, oh, if you want to write to the screen, you're going to set registers in this way, and I'm going to look for that, for example. And this code, as we alluded to last time, it needs to be safe. It can't allow the program to do bad things. So we need to, for example, carefully enforce all file permissions. If we don't do that, we're lost. The program's going to be able to do things it doesn't do, and this is much trickier than you'd think to write correctly because there's a lot of control the program has over how it runs this handler. So kind of our normal operation, have this diagram here where time goes down. Our program is running, it encodes its request to the OS in registers, and then it runs this special system call instruction. And that's going to switch the processor to kernel mode and jump to this handler, the operating system setup. That's going to read those registers, figure out what the program wants to do, and maybe even do the thing the program wants to do. And then in the most common case, we'll go back to the program again. As we learn later, we don't have to do that. Maybe we want to get rid of the program, do some other program, but we can go back to user mode and run something after handling the system. Next, questions? Okay, so I'd like to make a little note about terminology. So this special instruction we say is the system call instruction. And as we'll see on x86-64, it's even called syscall. And I will often say that, oh, that's a system call. That instruction, that jump, is a system call. So the system call is entering kernel mode on request to run this routine. That's a thing we'll often say as a system call. Sometimes people will colloquially say that, oh, well, a system call is this whole thing. And we have the same terminology issue with function calls that you've probably seen. Like, so if you have a call to Fibonacci, sometimes people will say that just the call, just starting the Fibonacci function, well, that's a function call. Sometimes people will say, oh, the function call is from when the Fibonacci function starts, including all the work it does and any recursive calls until it returns. That's the function call. You'll hear both terminology, and you need to know context to know, are people referring to just starting the function or doing the whole thing? Same thing is true with system calls. I will try to be explicit when it matters, which this distinction matters, when it matters when I'm referring to the whole process of handling the request or just making the request to the system. Questions on this terminology? Okay, so let's look specifically at how system calls look from the user, the program side, on Linux, on 64-bit x86 Linux. So the instruction we're using is called syscall, and this is that go to kernel mode, jump to the OS routine that was set up at boot. And the Linux implementation has chosen a calling convention for system calls. And what they've chosen is that we're going to put in RAX what they call a system call number, which is what kind of operation. So examples of kinds are like open, read, exit, create socket. So we'll have a bunch of different kinds of operations we can do, and which one we do will be specified in the register RAX. This is just what the Linux developers have decided. And why is it RAX? Because the code that we're running is looking in RAX. If they decided to look in a different register, we put it in a different register. And this kind of is like the sort of target address of a call. But unlike the target address of a normal call, right, we can only have this sort of table of valid numbers, and that's all the operations we have. But it's like the target address of a call in that this specifies kind of what actual operation we're running. And then the remaining parameters are kind of the arguments. And if you have memorized the calling convention from CS01 or wherever you may have seen x86 assembly before, you might realize, wait, this matches how arguments are normally passed on Linux. Like normally, if we had a normal function, not a system call, the first argument would be an RAX, the second would be an RSI, and so on. And that's a very deliberate decision the Linux developers made, because as we'll see, it makes it easier to run system calls from C. So we make this system call, the handler runs, it's going to look at these registers, decide what to do about our request, and afterwards, it's going to go back to our code after setting REX to the return value of the system call. And Linux has a convention that it will set REX to a negative number if there's some sort of error. So you'll notice, except for this REX thing, this calling convention is basically the same as a normal function call. That's what the Linux developers decided, because, well, system calls are kind of like our special function calls, in a way. So to give an example of usage here, here's a Hello World program. So I set in this case, REX to 1, which is the system call number for what, and there's a table I looked up and found out that system call number 1 is right. And I need to specify arguments, so I specify my first argument as 1, which indicates to standard out. I pass a pointer to this string here and a length of the string. That's, I think, off by 1. And I have these arguments, and I run syscall, and this is going to go to the OS code in kernel mode. And run it, and that's going to eventually return and get back here after doing my request, hopefully writing hello world to wherever my program's output is going. Then I make a second system call. I request the operation exit, which has system call number 60. I pass an argument of 0. This 0 is like what the return value for main or the argument to the C function exit. It's in status for the program that's running me to figure out how I terminate it. We'll talk about that very specifically later in the semester, but that's why there's an argument to exit here. So questions about my simple program? Yes?
So you said that during when you do syscall and there's an error, it would return negative 1 times the error number. In the event of a success, what would the REX return like?
Question. I said in the error, system calls on Linux conventionally return a negative number. What is it on success? It depends on the system call. In the case of write, the return value is how many bytes were successfully written. And in the case of exit, it doesn't return. Yes?
Are there any system calls that are read operations, I need to access this and get a specific
method? Are there any system calls that are read operations? Yes. So for example, there's a read system call. And the way the read system call works specifically is that you pass in a buffer and it writes to that buffer. So it uses that pattern we saw where we pass a pointer to the thing we want returned. And that's most commonly what you'll see for those types of system calls. You know, though conceptually we could imagine returning it one integer at a time through REX. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. And I guess one thing I'd like to mention is why do we have a system call for exit? And if you think about it, what you do in a normal C program is you just return. The problem with returning is that, we have to return to somewhere. And in this case, I've written a program here that's meant to run without the C standard library. And that's why my starting point is underscore start. So normally when you're writing a C program, you write main, and there's actually some code probably written in an assembly that calls your main function. And that's why your main function can return. But if I'm not writing that code, I'm just doing this kind of without the help of that, well, there's nowhere for me to return to. And I can't myself do what my program does when it exits. If we think of what a program exiting means, it means other things should run. I don't have access to the other programs. So I need to make a request to the OS saying, hey, please help me exit. Because it's not something I'm capable of doing on my own. questions about our exiting? Yeah?
Do you have to like exit out of every single program? Like what happens if you just don't put anything in?
So what happens if we don't put anything in? So if you're running a program in C, there's some code the compiler wrote that calls main. And when you return from that, you return back to that code, and that code is going to have a call to exit. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
If you don't have something that's like calling your main or similar, you need to handle that. If I didn't do that, well, I'd get something like a seg fault from executing invalid code since there's no valid code here. Other questions? Okay, and so I mentioned that this syscall goes into a handler in the US, and what we imagine that handler might do is it looks like a function. It saves a whole bunch of registers and where to return back to, and then probably looks up in a table of functions to handle reading and exiting and all the other operations we might request. It uses REX to look up what function to actually run after checking if REX is a valid number to look up in that table, runs that and then goes back. And to give an example of kind of system calls in Linux, I'm giving here the names of these C functions that conventionally call these system calls. Since obviously, as we saw, they're actually identified by a number. So we have system calls for allocating memory, because we mentioned in our introduction that when your program accesses memory, it actually goes through this mapping the OS sets up. So if you want to do something that changes that, you need to ask the OS to make a request. We have system calls for creating new processes and for changing what program is running in the current process. You might ask, why are these separate? We'll talk about that later. We have our system call for terminating a process, for accessing files. If you remember doing a sockets lab in CSO1, you call things like socket and accept. Those are implemented as system calls with system calls that pretty much directly do that operation. Now, some cases for handling system calls don't quite look like the diagram I showed before. In particular, we can handle the system call in a way where we don't immediately do something and go back to the original program. So one common example is, let's say the request I'm making for the OS is I'd like to read from the keyboard, and I haven't typed anything on the keyboard. The OS is not likely to just sit there looking at the keyboard, staring and saying, is there a key press yet? Is there a key press yet? Is there a key press yet? That's not what it's going to do. It's instead going to find something else to do. So our sort of timeline is that you make the request. It figures out, oh, you want to read from the keyboard. It figures out, I can't do that right now. I have better stuff to do. Let's do that better stuff. And sometime later, it's going to figure out, oh, now there was something from the keyboard. Let's go back to the program and say, yep, got your read from the keyboard done. Another case where our system call kind of won't go immediately back to the program, we already saw, with our, if our request is to exit the program, what is that system call doing? Well, it's going to go to the handler. It's going to figure out, oh, this program wants to exit. Well, going to go on to do something else, not going to go back to the program that wants to exit. That doesn't make any sense. So we're going to do something else, and that's fine. The system call doesn't need to return to where it started. And we'll get into this a little more later today. This case especially. So I mentioned we have these C functions. I mentioned these were the names of C functions that typically call the system call. And colloquial people will sometimes tell you that specific C functions like open or any of the one mmap or fork or execve are system calls. And well, they aren't literally, because if I write in C, code like this, when it compiles, this is going to look like move something into RDI, move something into RSI, and then call open. There's no syscall instruction in my call to the open function. But we know that it's supposed to make a system call, so how does it work? Well, how it works is that we're making a call to a library function. But there's a bunch of library functions that I'll call system call wrappers that exist to kind of bridge the gap between what we can write in C and what we can write in assembly. So in assembly, I can actually write this special syscall instruction here. I can't write C code that generates that. So instead, the standard library has provided us with functions that wrap most system calls, including this example for open. So we'll call this assembly function provided by our library maker, and it's going to do something like this, where it's going to set the system call number. And in this case, system call number 2 on Linux corresponds to the open operation. And it happens that Linux carefully chose where the arguments besides the system call number were to match how normal function calls work. So I don't need to set RDI or RSI. They've already been set in my code that calls this function. So I'll set the system call number, call syscall, and typically these system call wrappers also do a little bit of interpretation of the return value. So in this case, if the return value is negative, they put the error in a variable called erno and return negative 1 from the C wrapper function, otherwise they leave the return value unchanged. Erno is a global variable in this case. So these are system call wrappers, and sometimes people will colloquially and imprecisely say, oh, this is the open syscall or the read syscall when you call one of these wrappers. But it's not the syscall exactly, it's just a teeny function that only exists to make a syscall for you because you can't write syscall in C. Questions about what this system call wrapper does. And so our typical usage would be code like this. I'm opening input.txt, checking if I have an error, looking at erno, and then using that return value in some way later on. Okay, so we've seen what system calls look like, and if you want to look at what system calls programs actually make, there's a nice tool on Linux called strace, which is a system call tracer. It's basically, a special debugger where it prints out what's happening at every system call. It prints it out in the format you'd use to call a wrapper function, but it's actually basically setting a breakpoint on every syscall instruction and looking at the registers. And running my Hello World program from earlier, we can see when I run strace to look at what it does, I see that I have something switching to that program, and then that program runs, it makes its write system call and its exit system call that I wrote in that assembly. And we can also try this with a more realistic program. So here I have the same program as far as what it seems to do, but written in kind of more normal C. And you notice I need a lot more space for the strace output, because as I mentioned earlier, when we have a normal C program, There's some code in the standard library that runs main. And we can see that that code is doing a bunch of things. So here it's allocating some memory, setting up the heap. It's figuring out what kind of system we're on. It's configuring something called thread local storage that we might talk about much later in the semester. It's figuring out where my program's located, allocating more memory, checking for a configuration file, figuring out if our output is going to a terminal or not, because that changes how puts works. Then actually writing and exiting using a slightly different system call. So same idea, but like there's actually a whole bunch of requests to OS going on when we're running a normal program. You know, this is all stuff that the library does that you don't typically care about. Yes?
Is libc dynamically or statically linked?
In this example, we're statically linked.
So it's like just depending on, I guess, the context it runs in, or is there always going to be?
So all these system calls, in this case, because it's statically linked, are from code that is actually in the executable that was copied from libc. So if we do the same thing for a dynamically linked version, I have that slide. We actually can see that some of the code that runs loads libc, actually opens up the C library and reads it and loads it. And that's done with request to the OS, because our program can't just do that itself. It used to do that, and when we have a dynamically linked program, it's set up to have that code available. Does that answer your question? So the question is, what's the difference between how I built this program and how I built this one? So here I did something like GCC minus static. And here I did something with GCC without the static option. And same thing for claim. Yeah, same idea. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we see we have these wrapper functions, and we also know that some other functions like use these system calls maybe less directly. Like we see this puts turns into a write, you know, including adding the new line, so puts is implemented with write, but it's not like just a wrapper around write. There's a bunch of extra stuff going on. So can modify this picture and say that generally what we do as in our programs is that we have our applications are written not to the system call interface, but typically they're written to use a library interface. And that library interface is implemented using the system call interface. In some cases, we have these wrappers where it's like basically just forwarding the result, forwarding what we pass in directly to the system call. In some cases, something a lot more complicated is going on. Like if we think of printf, printf turns into those write calls where we don't have any formatting. So like there's a bunch of stuff going on to like handle like if we're printing out a number. And the system call interface accesses the kernel, and that has access to our fully complete hardware interface. Questions? Okay, so let's talk about some other things that I mentioned at the top of the lecture our program shouldn't be able to do. So one thing, to first talk about these two things, which is modifying memory of programs that aren't ARCs. So this shouldn't work either by accident, we don't want a buggy program to break some unrelated program, or on purpose. So thinking about, you know, how that's supposed to work, let's say I have my two programs, A and B here, you know, I'm running them on a system like Portal, what do we expect to happen? And in program A, I have a global variable at address 10000, which has the value 42. And I'm gonna run this move instruction that loads from memory at that location into REX. And in program B, I'm going to copy to 99 to REX, and then copy REX to memory at address 10000. So first, like, what do we expect if we, these are running simultaneously on a shared machine like Portal, what do we expect REX to be? I have a bunch of possible options. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what you think should happen here. Who likes some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? It's definitely 42, okay. B, 99. C, okay. D, it's 42 or 99, but it depends on some things. But E, 42 or 99, or we might have a crash. F, something else, no clue. So we have a big split. So I would say what would be most convenient for us is that these are different programs. And if we're on a machine like Portal, maybe this is my program and this is your program. It'd be really nice if the answer is always 42. And in fact, in pretty much any normal multi-user OS, any OS you're likely to have used on a laptop or desktop or mobile phone, it's always 42, except if we very specifically set it up not to be. And the question is, like, why is that the case? Well, remember when we sort of gave our introduction, we said that when we have two different programs running, that they don't actually get to access memory addresses directly, they go through this mapping set by the OS. Now, there's a question of, like, well, what happens in process B when we put in address 10,000? So in program A, address 10,000, we know since we declared it, it goes somewhere over here. And what does address 10,000 do in program B? Well, it could go somewhere over here, maybe, or here, over, sorry, to program B's data or code, could go to one of these places, or maybe it goes nowhere. And often it might go, so we don't know, but there's an option in these mappings to trigger an error, or it could go here. We don't have enough information to know what program B's actually going to do. It might access some random data that it has at address 10000, or it might trigger an error that you often see displayed as segmentation fault when there's no mapping for an address. So on the B side, B might crash because we don't know what's at address 1000, or it might not, but unless we've specifically set things up in a weird way, it's not going to access program A stuff. Yeah. So let's say I wanted to access that. In that case, I'd have to request the OS set this mapping, like to, you know, give to explicitly have an extra entry for program B, which I could do, but that would definitely be something I'd have to request. It wouldn't happen automatically. Does that answer your question? And we will, in fact, see how to request that on Linux in the signals lab in a week. Or use some code that does it, as you say. So I talked about it crashing, and we should talk about what does it mean for a program to crash? What is actually happening on the processor if program B tries to access address 10000 and there's nothing there? That is not mapped for the program. The experience we have is some other program is informed of the crash and displays a message to us. And the processor starts executing something else. Right, the program doesn't keep going. And there's a question of how does the hardware do this? The hardware generally isn't going to be sophisticated enough to understand what programs are running. That's something that's going to be managed by software in the OS. It's not going to know how should I print out a message about this. Because, like, you know, we have, like, consider, like, logging in person versus SSHing in, right? That's a lot of stuff to do in sort of raw hardware. We want to delegate this to the operating system to figure out. And so when our program does these things that result in crashes, what's actually happening is the hardware saying, this program did something weird, and it's running the OS and saying, hey, OS, you figure out what to do. And this should remind you of system calls. In system calls, we had software asking the OS for help. These are cases where hardware is asking the OS for help. So we have these two different kinds of events, but they both trigger the same action, that we want to run an OS routine. We want to run that routine in kernel mode because it needs to have access to all the OS functionality, all the special things the OS can do. So we're going to take the thing we did for system calls and we're going to generalize it. We're just going to have a general way of having the OS run to handle some event. And we'll call this mechanism hardware exceptions. So we'll switch to kernel mode if we aren't there already and run this handler, the OS setup at boot. So the mechanism by which we're going to have the hardware do something in this situation is the same. The triggering event is different. With system calls, it's triggered because the instructions defined to trigger it. With something like this invalid memory access, it's triggered because the program did something erroneous that the hardware doesn't have a better way of handling. And there's going to be some more types of exceptions, but now we have this general category of exceptions, and we have these two kinds of causes. We have exceptions that are deliberately triggered by a program, asking the OS to do something, and we have exceptions that are triggered by some weird event in a program that the hardware can't figure out how to handle by itself. And these are both going to use the same mechanism. We're going to run an OS handler. That OS handler is going to figure out what happened. For a system call, it's going to figure out what did the program want to do. For one of these errors or events, it's going to figure out what was the program trying to do? Can I make that okay? If not, how do I crash the program and print appropriate message or run the debugger you know, whatever we need to do for that. And I mentioned accessing memory that's not valid. This also applies to what if I try to like talk directly to the hard drive in user mode? That's going to trigger one of these exceptions, ask the OS what to do about it. If I try to divide by zero, if I try to run junk that's not valid machine code, all these trigger this handler in the OS because the processor doesn't have a way of figuring out what to do about it itself. And as this slide alludes, we're going to have one more category we're going to finish up with today of exceptions. But the ones we've talked about so far are all synchronous exceptions. They're triggered by the program we are running. But we're definitely going to want some other types of exceptions. And to motivate that, we're going to go back to our list of things we don't want programs to do. So one thing we don't want is we don't want a program to be able to just hang the system. So I don't want to take my favorite program here. Here's my favorite program. If I run 1,000 copies of that on Portal, it shouldn't be the case that you can't use Portal. We'd like to make that true, but with what we've seen so far, it would be the case. If I think about the assembly for this, right, I have, you know, the assembly is a jump instruction. There's nothing weird about the jump instruction. The processor is just going to execute that. There's not a system call there. The jump instruction isn't asking the OS for help. So with what we've learned so far, this would just mean that this would run forever, you know, when the OS jumped to this code. So we're going to work around that by having another case where we allow things that the program isn't doing to trigger the same exception mechanism. We're going to have events that are completely unrelated to whatever program is currently running that also need to be handled by the OS. And one category of this, maybe the most prominent, is we'll have these timer events. That typically when the OS runs a program that it is concerned might be an infinite loop like that, it's going to set a timer to go off in the hardware. And when that timer triggers, the hardware will use the exception mechanism to switch to kernel mode and the OS handler. That OS handler could say, oh, the timer went off. This program, maybe it's an infinite loop. Let's do something else instead of letting it keep running. We also are going to use this to handle input and output. So if I press a key, it might be the case that the program that's currently running isn't the one that's interested in that key press. But what's going to happen is we're going to have that key press signal to the hardware, hey, there's some input that needs to be handled. And the hardware will switch to an OS routine to handle that key press, even if we're in the middle of running a completely different program. And then the OS routine will figure out, what do I want to do with this key press? Maybe it will decide, I'm just going to save it for later and keep running the current program. Or maybe it will decide, I'm going to switch to the program that's interested in the key press. But it needs to be handled or else we'll like lose the key press. And this is also going to apply for like receiving data from the network. Or, for example, maybe I've queued something to be written to disk and I'm waiting for it to finish being written. These exceptions will notify the OS, hey, this is finished, what do you want to do about the disk write finishing, for example? So we have these different kinds of exceptions, and emphasize that these are kind of all under one umbrella. So we have exceptions, of which system calls are a type, what are reading calls interrupts, which are exception events external to the program that's currently running, but that need to be handled by the OS, like IO or that timer. And what are reading calls faults, which are unusual behavior of the currently running program, like your classic quote-unquote seg fault, bus error, things like that. These are all kinds of exceptions. So these have very different triggers, but they all use the same mechanism where they're going to have the hardware help us switch to kernel mode and run a routine the OS specified to handle this event and do whatever the OS thinks needs to be done. And obviously, because they have such different triggers, what the OS thinks needs to be done is going to go all over the map. And we end up with this kind of general idea of how exceptions work, is that we're running some program, most likely in user mode, not necessarily, could be in some other exception, and something triggers an exception, maybe it's the program, maybe it's something else, whatever triggers it, we start the exception handler in kernel mode, the OS handles whatever happened, and then the OS finishes handling it and goes back, typically to user mode. And as is noted in this diagram, the OS is not obliged to immediately return to the program that triggered the exception, or to ever return to that program. But it's going to go to run something after the exception finishes being handled. Some questions about this general process? So the notion that we can go handle an exception and go back to a different program gives us what we'll call time multiplexing. That if you think of my infinite loop program, well, my infinite loop program will be happily running, and then some sort of event will trigger the OS to run through an exception. It could be a timer going off. It could be maybe input from the network. But something causes the OS to run, and even with a single core, since the OS runs, it can switch to a different program when it handles that exception, and often will. So in this example, it runs SSH for a bit. SSH finishes whatever it's doing, probably. It runs Firefox for a bit, and then, for some reason, switches back to my loop. It goes off. And what's ultimately happening here is that we're sharing the processor over time with multiple programs. And we're doing switching between the programs, and this switch is known as a context switch, because what is the OS doing? Well, when we handle that exception, we're going to save all the registers and everything about where the program was, its program counter, and what memory it had accessible. We're going to stash that somewhere for later. So in this case, I'm going to save loop's registers, and we're going to restore the registers of some other program. And then later on, we're going to use the registers we saved to switch back to that program at some point, most likely. Yes?
What if the program that's running just doesn't need to hand control back over to the operating system?
So question, what if the program that's running doesn't need to hand control back over to the operating system? So just freeze the whole system. So as we mentioned, that's why we have these set category of events that will cause the OS to run no matter what the program's doing. And for an infinite loop, like our biggest like preventer is that the OS will set a timer to go off, limiting how long the loop can run without the OS getting a chance to check things. Does that answer your question? So we do this saving of old state and restoring of new state. This is called a context switch. As you might guess from the name, the state information we're saving and restoring is called a context. So conceptually what's happening is initially our processor has all the registers for program A. These point to program A's memory. And the OS has program B, which isn't currently running, but has its registers saved in its memory. And then at some point, the OS gets to run and decides, oh, I want to go back to program B instead of program A. So it will take program A's memory registers and put them in its memory and copy program B's registers to the processor. And this gives us what we call a thread, that we have this idea where each program has the illusion it has its own processor. Why does it have its own processor? Well, what is it? What's on a processor? Registers and a program counter. Well, they each have their own one, but what's actually happening is that there are many threads sharing one processor, and the OS is handling storing these values when they're not on the real processor. So that is what we call a thread. And we'll talk a lot more about threads much later in the semester, but this is kind of something that's enabled by this exception mechanism, this idea of time multiplexing and making it look like you own the processor. So next time, we'll talk a bit more about those external exceptions, especially how I/O works, since that's not extremely intuitive.